At Cool Air Products, we developed AC Smart Seal Quick Shot with professionals in mind. It's the only product on the market that's 3-in-1, with sealant, lubricant, and UV dye all in a single application. It's non-toxic, non-flammable, 100% safe to the touch, eco-friendly, and compatible with all refrigerants. It's a safe solution option, backed by years of R&D, Intertech tested, and has sealed millions of leaks. AC Smart Seal, the professional's choice.
So every once in a while, we have to step out of our comfort zone and learn some new things. Now, CO2 is not something I know about as a refrigerant, okay? A natural refrigerant. We have an opportunity here to learn a little bit more about CO2 with Patrick Clardy from Danfoss. And it's not really a high-end conversation. It's more of a basic conversation, an introduction to. So we're not talking too technically or too in-depth. We're just getting a general idea of what CO2 is, how it works, the pressures it works at, what sort of applications you'll find it in, just stuff like that, very basic stuff. So let's get to this podcast, guys. This is the HVAC Know-It-All Podcast. I'm your host, Gary McCready. This podcast is sponsored by Master, and one of the cool initiatives they have going is they donated a bunch of equipment to Mohawk College for their heat pump training course, Move Air Fujitsu York. And I was part of that last Friday and got to see what the students were up to. These are apprentices and licensed technicians going back for, what do you call it? I think it's called micro training or something like that, where it's a few modules of training online or in book and then in the shop. So it's a very cool training, and I was glad to be part of it. Check out master.ca. This podcast is sponsored by Cintas. Cintas provides uniforms for the blue-collar trades through their website. So if you're looking to outfit your team with some clothing coming up for the spring here, some spring jackets, pants, t-shirts, hoodies, you name it, check out cintas.com/HVAC Know-It-All.
Welcome to the HVAC Know-It-All Podcast. Recorded from a basement somewhere in Toronto, Canada. Your host and HVAC tech, Gary McCready, will take you on a deep dive into the industry, discussing all things HVAC. From storytelling to technical discussion. Enjoy the show.
All right, so CO2, Patrick, is something that I'm not into as far as working on it. I've never had experience touching it, working on systems that contain it. And this conversation is for me to learn more about CO2 from yourself. And it's for my audience to learn more about it if they haven't already worked on it themselves and know a lot about it. I mean, it is a natural refrigerant, but there's many different caveats to it that are different from working on, for instance, older refrigerants like R22, 404A, any sort of refrigerant that was used in refrigeration applications. So, I mean, give us a rundown on CO2. We're going to have a basic conversation, so let's keep it basic. But tell us what CO2 is all about.
It's if you're not accustomed to it, it is quite a bit different than what you're used to with, let's say, the chemical refrigerants. When it comes to chemical refrigerants, we've seen a lot over the years, right? A lot of changes, a lot of new refrigerants replacing old ones, especially nowadays with the HFC phase down. We're seeing a lot of new chemical refrigerants again. But basically all these refrigerants work more or less the same. The system doesn't change that much when you change from one chemical to another chemical. When it comes to CO2, the game changes.
Yeah.
We all know about the pressures. Pressures are way higher than what you're used to with some of the chemical refrigerants. And I'm not talking 1, 2, 3 bars or PSI, as you're probably used to. We're talking maybe 5-6 times higher on a warm day.
Yeah.
Right. So that's one thing you have to take into account. Other than that, we have some different system layout. Typically, when you look at your standard, let's say, chemical system, it basically has the four elements. We have a compressor, we have an evaporator, we have an injection valve, we have a liquid receiver. the basically the four elements you have. When we're looking at CO2 systems, like I said, the game changes somewhat, because we suddenly have valves in places where you're not used to having valves. Mm-hmm. And this can change the game, right? And this can make you confuse a little bit.
Yeah.
Because it's suddenly you have a valve somewhere in a line where you never seen it. And that can be difficult to understand. What does that valve do? Why is it there? How is it controlled? And that can be, yeah, if you've never seen a CO2 system, that can be difficult to understand the first time. So you really have to look at drawings to understand how does this system work. But even then, you need some help probably the first time to really get to grips with a CO2 system. And we can go through some of the layouts, how, let's say, a typical CO2 system would look like. Because in the old days, and I'm talking old days as in 20 years ago, the first CO2 systems were what we call subcritical systems. So that means the pressure didn't go up that high, because basically the systems were used for freezing low temp applications.
Okay.
So that meant we were running on relatively low pressures. And when you're running at a subcritical system, and I can show you when a CO2 system goes from subcritical to what we call transcritical. In the subcritical area, a CO2 system works just like any other chemical system. You have your condenser works as a condenser, so you go from hot gas to liquid. But when we go transcritical, that's when the game changes a lot. And then we suddenly have a whole different ball game, so to say.
I see. Okay. So, I mean, transcritical, can you maybe explain what exactly transcritical means? And earlier you were saying that the pressures are higher. And I think you might have thrown in the word obviously or something along those lines. But the people listening to this probably don't fully understand that the pressures are higher and how much higher they are.
Yeah, and that's the problem with me being in CO2 for quite some time. You tend to forget that it's not so common to everybody. So pardon me for that one. But when we're talking about pressures, let's say on a normal day when it's not too hot, too warm or too cold outside, pressures might range, and I'm talking in bar here, might range somewhere between 50, 60, 70 bar, right? That's a normal day, not even a warm, hot summer day,
mm-hmm.
right? When we're talking on a hot summer day, then we might be talking about pressures going over 100 bars. So then you could be running probably at a maximum up to 110 bar, more or less.
110 bar. So most of the people listening to this will be working in PSI. You wouldn't have a conversion for that, would you, in PSI?
No, I hope that you could, but we can easily look it up. But I'm coming from Europe. I tend to work in bar. So
okay.
Sorry about that
110. I'm going to look it up real quick. 110 bars to PSI. That is, wow, that is 1595. So 1595.42 PSI.
Yeah, and that would most likely be your maximum, right? That's on a warm summer day. So that's what you're up against. People then tend to think that when using CO2, because of these high pressures, you can only work with steel piping or stainless steel piping. But still, that's not true. That might be true if we go into really large systems with large diameter pipes.
Yep.
But when we're talking in, let's say, regular supermarkets, food retail applications, still we talk about copper piping. But it might be a special copper piping, right? We have the what we call a K65 copper. So that's a copper steel alloy. Mm-hmm. It looks like copper. Looking on the outside, you don't see anything different, but it does have a different structure. You can solder it and work with it as you would any other copper pipe. Yep. So you don't notice anything different, but it is way stronger than common copper. And that is what is typically used in CO2 systems.
Okay, now where would you normally see right now CO2 is, are we mainly seeing it in grocery store applications, or is there a transition to other systems as we speak right now? Can you give us a little bit of insider information on that?
Supplyhouse.com in the US is a very good option for ordering parts and tools for your HVAC, mechanical, electrical jobs. They have all kinds of stuff within their store, distribution centers across the US, so it doesn't take forever for the parts or the tools to get to your door or your job site. So if you're looking to up your game with some online e-commerce stuff for your HVAC jobs, check out supplyhouse.com.
Yeah, sure. We all know CO2 is not new, right? It started in the 1800s, then disappeared for a long time when the chemical refrigerants came up, and then it made a big comeback, let's say, in the early 2000s. Where it started was in what we call the Nordics. You would say the Nordics is somewhere north up in Canada, but for me, coming from Europe, the Nordics is Scandinavia, so the northern part of Europe. That's where CO2 basically came back first, and it started in the most common application, what we call food retail or supermarket applications. That's where it started first. From there, it moved down in Europe, going south. And after that, when whole Europe basically was accustomed to having CO2 supermarkets, that's also when it started to spread out to other industries. So at the moment, we don't see CO2 anymore only in food retail. That might still be the largest share. But basically, we see CO2 everywhere these days, going into smaller systems. We even see cars that have a CO2 AC. We see small CO2 heat pumps, even for domestic use, but typically in a little bit larger sizes. We see also small supermarkets, or what we call convenience stores. We see CO2 these days, but also in the going in the upper part, going into industrial refrigeration. And that is something that I guess a lot of people would never have guessed, that CO2 would migrate even there, because as we all know, CO2 in industrial refrigeration, ammonia is the biggest and probably best refrigerant out there for these large industrial systems. But even there, we now see CO2 taking part of, let's say, the lower part of industrial refrigeration, where the super large systems will still be ammonia and will probably always be ammonia. Now in the somewhat smaller industrial systems, we see CO2 moving in and taking over and taking share of what used to be ammonia. So basically, we see CO2 moving everywhere these days.
Yeah, and where did the movement for CO2 come from? Like, I mean, obviously, manufacturers out there are trying to use sort of earth-based or natural refrigerants. Where did the movement come from to test CO2 in a system? Like, is there any history that you can give us on that? Do you know anything about the history on CO2, when and where it started to be tested?
Yeah, well, of course, as we all know, we are, or at least our industry is in trouble using HFC refrigerants because of the environment. We have a lot of phase downs coming with the Montreal Protocol, Kigali Amendment. So we all have to take care of the environment, and we cannot use the refrigerants anymore as we used to. And that's basically where the whole movement came from, right? In Europe, 20, 25 years ago, when the whole CO2 revival started, that had to do with the HFC phase down, right? That's when the first signs were coming that we really have to phase down the chemical refrigerants that are wreaking havoc on our planet. And at the time in Europe, there were no alternatives, right? Mm-hmm. These days, we have a lot of alternatives on the market, HFOs, and we can go into a whole discussion if that's a good alternative, yes or no, but at least it complies with the regulations. Yep. But 20 years ago, all those new refrigerants, they were not there, right? The only alternative was to go natural. And the most likely alternative at the moment, at the time, was CO2, because propane, we didn't have a lot of experience with it at the time. And also the charge limit of propane having the flammability issue was a problem as well. Ammonia was mainly only used in large industrial systems. So the only route to take was CO2. And that's still going. And at the moment, we have around 70,000 CO2 systems in Europe only, and climbing by about 15,000 a year, more or less.
Wow.
So that's huge. Yeah, it's growing really fast still, and really taking off still the last few years even.
So let me ask you about safety considerations when working on CO2, because that pressure is high. Is there any safety concerns working around CO2 equipment when we're servicing, installing? Is there anything that we should be keeping in mind? Because, I mean, if something blows off a system at that pressure, it's going to do a lot of damage. It could hurt someone. It could even kill someone if you're standing in front of it. So is there any sort of safety concerns that we need to put in place there?
Yes, of course, we have safety concerns, just like any other system. Of course, there's a little bit more. First of all components that are in the system, all the valves, compressors, gas cooler, as we call the condenser in a CO2 systems, they all have to be rated for a certain pressure so they can take the pressure that's in the system. Apart from this, we see safety valves or blow-off valves, or however you want to call them, basically in each part of the system.
Okay.
So if we have what we call a CO2 booster system, and I can explain later what exactly a CO2 booster system is, we have safety valves in each pressure part of the system. So going from freezing up to cooling, so LT and MT, up to the high pressure part of the system and the liquid part of the system, you can have up to 4 safety valves in one CO2 system, all rated for a different pressure. So they all blow at a different pressure. So there will never be any issues with the components. When the pressure goes up too much, the valve will blow, right? Then that's more or less the only safety device that's in place, apart from maybe stopping the system when there's a large CO2 leak. Of course, that's also can happen because CO2, it pushes out oxygen, mm-hmm. right? So if it leaks in the large cold room, it pushes all the oxygen to the floor. So when you walk into that cold room, there's not a lot of oxygen for you to breathe.
I see.
So that means that in a cold room or in an engine room or even in a supermarket, there will be gas detectors that can detect large CO2 concentrations if they're there and shut down the system if needed.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, as far as tools go, there was one individual that was debating on tools, because there is it was a manufacturer of gauges that were making a manifold set for CO2 for checking system pressures and operation for service, maintenance, stuff like that. But he was saying that all these CO2 systems are all set up with their own onboard digital gauges and sometimes analog gauges as well. Is there a need to own a set of gauges to test CO2, or do we have everything we need already on these systems to monitor?
So Emerson has their second generation variable speed compressor. Now, it looks impressive when it comes to efficiency, 25 SEER rating, that's pretty good when it comes to a variable speed scroll compressor. The other thing that's interesting about it is it does not need a crankcase heater because it has stator heating inside of it. So basically the windings around the rotor, the stator, it has a way to keep the stator warm to keep the compressor warm. So there's no need for an external crankcase heater. That's pretty cool technology, and it runs off a control board and a drive as well. So if you have a minute, check out their second generation online scroll compressors, variable speed and A2L compatible.
What do you mean, test CO2, or do you mean to monitor what's in going inside?
Yeah. So like if you have a manifold gauge in your service van that you would use to check system pressure, mm-hmm. charge, you know what I mean? Is there a need to have a manifold for a CO2 system, or is everything already built so we can test and monitor pressures on the system itself from how it's built?
Yeah, a lot of you have to understand that all these CO2 systems, because they're all quite new, right? We don't have any CO2 systems running from 30 years ago. They're all, let's say, relatively new, so they all have the latest technology inside. And to run a CO2 system, you need controllers,
yeah.
right? You don't do this with a pressostat, right? You control a CO2 system with a lot of electronic controllers. And there are a lot of brands out there, including my own, and a lot of different other brands. So all these systems tend to have electronic controllers running the evaporator, running the compressors. They tend to have what we call a system manager or a system monitoring system on board, quite often with a screen where you can already on the screen, on the system, in the engine room, can look at some of the pressures that are in the system, can look at some of the superheat going on, can look at the valve openings. So, and of course, also you do have manual gauges also on the system quite often. So you tend not to use your gates in your service van a lot, but every technician running CO2, working on CO2, will have it in their van always as a standard tool, basically, because you might need to charge the system for any reason. So you need hoses, you need gauges, you need to know what you're doing. But 9 out of 10 times, the system will have either a monitoring system with already a screen somewhere in your engine room where you can look at some of the pressures and what's going on in the system, or there are manual gauges. But of course, it can depend OEM to OEM, depends on who builds the system, who builds the rack, what accessories they put on.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, as far as the basic refrigeration cycle goes, I mean, if we look at traditionally, we have a compressor, we have a condenser metering device, and an evaporator. Are we still using the conventional or traditional refrigeration cycle when it comes to CO2? Are we still using that same thought process?
Yes. Basically, the refrigeration principle hasn't changed.
Okay.
We still need to put liquid into our evaporators. We still have a compressor on the other side of the evaporator, sucking in cold gas and making hot discharge gas. Nothing like that changes. So what you know about refrigeration, you can still use if you go into CO2. The whole system layout, as I said, that changes a bit from chemical refrigerants to CO2. And I mentioned the word booster systems earlier, and that's something I can show you if you want to go into that right now. Just to show you how does, let's say, a very standard CO2 system look like, as you would encounter this in any supermarket.
Okay, sure.
Let me share my screen for the people who are looking this on the screen, and I'll try to see if I can explain it a little bit All right, let's go. So I hope you can see my screen here.
I can, yeah.
So I'll try to explain what we have here. So this is what we call a booster system, and we call it a booster system because basically we have to discharge from what we call the LT evaporators or low temp refrigerators or freezing evaporators. The discharge gas from the LT compressors is going into the suction of the medium temp, the MT compressors. So we have one system for a whole supermarket, so to say. So we, in the older days, we used to have a refrigeration system for the LT side or freezing side, and we used to have a separate refrigeration system for the cooling or MT side. These days, with CO2 systems, we call it a transcritical system. We have a booster system, so we have one system for the whole supermarket, not two systems anymore. And they are intertwined. So we have basically, as you know from any refrigeration system, we start with liquid that goes into the evaporators. And that's the same for CO2. So we have liquid going in to the empty evaporators. We have liquid going into the LT evaporators. It's the same liquid line feeding both. And we have LT compressors, so freezing compressors, sucking the gas in from the LT evaporators. And then we have the discharge from the LT compressors is going into the suction of the cooling compressors, or what we call MT compressors. And they also are there to suck in the gas coming from the MT evaporators. So basically, we have one system. We have two levels of pressures from compressors, mainly LT compressors on the freezing, MT compressors on the cooling. Those are two different suction pressures, so to say. On the top here, we have one common discharge line, what you see here, the part in the red. Yep. We have one common discharge line going into what we call the gas cooler. And in CO2, we don't call it a condenser anymore. We call it a gas cooler because that's the nature of CO2. Once you go above this critical point, and this is this happens at around 70 bar or 31 degrees Celsius, that's when CO2 goes from being subcritical to transcritical. And that's a relatively low temperature, right? Basically, any refrigerant has a transcritical point, right? But you tend not to reach it. You never reach that within in the chemical refrigerants. In CO2, it's on a pretty low level, so you can easily go over that point and go into the transcritical system or transcritical area. And once you go into the transcritical area, there is basically no distinction anymore between liquid and gas. Okay. And that's the part that's really hard to fathom, yeah, if you're not into this CO2 stuff, right? So, and because you're into this phase where there, basically it is a gas that has a lot of properties from liquid. So it's really hard to distinguish between liquid and gas, basically. And it also doesn't condense as a normal refrigerant does. So the only thing you can do is cool it down. And that happens in the gas cooler. By the way, a CO2 gas cooler looks exactly the same as any HFC condenser. Okay. By the way, it's exactly the same principle. Same thing, different pressure rating, of course. It does exactly the same. It moves air across the CO2 and you cool it down. So you always, what you have coming out of your gas cooler is always a mixture of pressure and a mixture of liquid and gas coming out. The only also downside of when you're in this transcritical area is that there is no connection anymore between pressure and temperature. And that's also something that's maybe a bit alien if you're not used to this kind of stuff, because we always know if we have a discharge temperature, that always correlates with a pressure, and vice versa. Pressure, temperature, temperature, pressure. If you move into this transcritical area, there is no connection between temperature and pressure anymore. So you have to control them separately. So basically, the fans that are on the gas cooler slash condenser, they control the temperature. And behind this gas cooler, we suddenly have a valve that's on the outlet of the gas cooler. And this valve, that controls the pressure inside the gas cooler. And this valve is there because of the reason, like I said, temperature and pressure have to be controlled separately.
Wow, okay.
Because normally, if you want to control the pressure, basically you can ramp up, ramp down your fans mm-hmm. on the condenser. Yeah. When you change the temperature, you also change the pressure.
Yeah.
And that's not the case in CO2. So that's why we suddenly have a valve in the gas cooler outlet controlling the pressure. So that's your first additional valve, right? That valve you don't see in any traditional system. And this tends to be a stepper valve, being controlled by the PEC controller. From there, behind that valve, we have a liquid receiver, like you do in any traditional refrigeration system. And that receiver contains liquid. But we also have gas. Like I said, we have gas and liquid coming out of the gas cooler. So in that receiver, we have to first control the pressure. That's important. We don't want the pressure to be too high. And we also want to remove the gas from that receiver. And that's done with an extra line that you see here moving out of the receiver. So basically what you're used to is you have one line going into the receiver and one line going out of the receiver. And now we have a third line in this receiver going out. And there we have the second valve that you're not used to in any traditional system. And this is what we call the flash gas valve or flash gas bypass valve. It can have several different names. And this valve is there to control the pressure inside this receiver. And basically, there's another stepper valve here being controlled again by the PEC controller. And this one opens and closes based on the pressure inside the receiver. So more or less, you give your receiver a set point. This tends to be around 40 bar. That's still more or less the average we see in CO2 receivers. And this control, this valve opens and closes depending on the actual pressure in that receiver. And it moves the gas to the empty compressors. And that's basically your typical CO2 system, because from the bottom of that receiver, we have liquid coming out, feeding the evaporators again.
Interesting.
And that's what we call a CO2 booster system. Mm. So all in all, the refrigeration principle, we don't touch it, right? We still have evaporators, we still have compressors, we still have injection valves in front of the evaporators. The only thing is we have this high pressure valve after the gas cooler to control the pressure inside the gas cooler, because pressure and temperature are not connected anymore. And we have this extra stepper valve controlling the pressure in the receiver. Apart from that, it's just refrigeration.
Hmm. Very interesting. Yeah, it's definitely a different animal. I find it very interesting that the temperature and the pressures are not correlating like a regular refrigerant the way you explain, and we have to control the temperature in the gas cooler and the pressure in the gas cooler with two separate means. That's pretty interesting to me, and that's what I can see is one of the main differences here between CO2 and the old style chemical refrigerants that we're used to. What is the future for CO2 here? Do you think it's a viable refrigerant moving forward? Do you think we're going to experiment for a little while and continue to implement systems with CO2, or do you think it's got a short lifespan until we move into something else? Like, what are your thoughts there?
CO2 for sure is here to stay.
Is it okay?
There's no getting away for CO2 from CO2. Like I said, it's here to stay for sure, because in the end, the regulations when it comes to chemical refrigerants, be it any kind of chemical refrigerants, they're getting more strict by the year. Right? We have a global phase down. And maybe Europe is a little bit ahead of the rest of the world because that's where it started first. But the rest of the world is catching up pretty quickly, right? Also in US, also Canada, they're all HFC phase down plans in place,
yeah,
that you have to abide by. And the rules are getting stricter by the year,
yeah,
right? So what we call the GWP limit, the global warming potential limit, is getting lower and lower by the year, and it's getting harder and harder to use chemical refrigerants. So in the end, if we talk really long term, basically natural refrigerants is the only solution that will stay. And there are several natural refrigerants, right? It's not only CO2 out there. We have propane, we have butane, isobutane, we have ammonia. There are several, and they all have their own application, right? You cannot use every natural refrigerant everywhere. But CO2 is pretty broad. You can use it from cooling to freezing to air conditioning to heat pumps, but it has its limits, right? So you might need to use another natural refrigerant, but still the next 10, 20 years, we will still also see a lot of chemical refrigerants out there. But like I said, it will be, yeah, more difficult to maintain these, okay, in the end.
So let me ask you one question before we head out. If we have a large system and we need to remove the refrigerant from that system, right, CO2, are we blowing it off into the atmosphere to the outdoors? We don't want to do it inside because it's going to displace the oxygen. But if we have to remove it, are we just opening up the system and letting it blow to the outside?
That would sound logical,
okay,
right? Because CO2 is a natural refrigerant. We basically also breathe it, more or less. But still, we all know about CO2 emissions. We have heard this. CO2 emissions are killing the planet, so to say. So also blowing off a complete CO2 system will not help the environment, right? So it's, of course, it's not as bad as some of the chemicals out there. But still, we do not blow it off.
Okay.
We do not just open the valve and let it go. You have to remove it in let's say a normal, respectable, professional way. But if there is still a little bit left, it doesn't hurt that much to just let the last bit go, or to leak a bit, because it's not that bad for the environment, right? It's a natural refrigerant. We basically, the refrigerant, the CO2 refrigerant we use in the systems is more or less also taken out of the environment to make a refrigerant. So, but still, we need to do this in a sustainable and professional way. So you remove it,
okay,
just like any other refrigerant.
All right. Now, my second question to that one would be, do we have special recovery machines for CO2 that can withstand the pressures? Or are we using, or just a special, is it a special unit designed for CO2, or can we use any recovery machine that we currently have?
Well, basically, it's a machine that does the same job for any other refrigerant. The problem, again, is the pressure, right? That's so you probably need a machine that can withstand a somewhat higher pressure.
Gotcha. Okay.
That's the only thing. There are differences when it comes to CO2, as we already explained the system layout. One of the other things we really need to take care of is, because you mentioned evacuating the system, but there is a really big difference when it comes to charging a system as well. Because we talked about this, and maybe I can show a picture again. We talked about this transcritical point where you move into from subcritical to transcritical. And we more or less already discussed what happens, right? So if you move from subcritical to transcritical, there's no distinction anymore between liquid and gas, and that causes some problems with the temperature and pressure not being connected anymore. But also on the other side, so this on the high side, we call this the critical point, and you reach this at 31 degrees Celsius or 74 bar, basically. On the other side, on the low side, we have a triple point. And this is also something to take into account, because at the triple point, this is where you have solid, liquid, and gas CO2 at the same time. And solid CO2 is dry ice, right? You've probably seen it or heard about it. Mm-hmm. And this is something you cannot have inside your system. But if you are commissioning a system and you're evacuating your system with your vacuum pump, you are at, let's say, -1 bar. You are really, really low. And if you at that time charge the system with liquid CO2, you create dry ice because you're below this triple point. So what you need to do is first charge the system with gas, CO2 gas, until you are above this triple point, let's say this 5.2 bar. And once you have crossed that point, that's when you can change from charging with gas to charging with liquid. And that's something also to take into account when charging a system. So you mentioned evacuating could be a problem. Also, charging is a bit different. But on the other hand, it's just getting used to it.
Perfect. Okay, so I mean, this was great, Patrick. I'm starting to learn a little bit more about CO2 as we move along here. Hopefully at some point I have a chance to work on it, because it would be pretty interesting to check it out in the field in person rather than just talking about it, because that's where most of us are going to learn the most, is actually getting a hands-on experience with it. But I think this conversation is a starting point for a lot of people that haven't touched it yet. So thank you very much for this. I really appreciate your time today.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Follow HVAC Know-It-All on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, Twitter, LinkedIn, and anywhere else Gary feels like popping up. This has been a Two Smokes and a Coffee production.